making the motion. I'm moving Allison. Would you stand, Ms. Allison Current?
The court will be happy to entertain your motion, Judge Rader.
Okay. Well, then, Allison is my current law clerk, and she is a member of the bar of the highest courts of Iowa, Minnesota, and the District of Columbia. And I don't think I have to convince my colleagues that she is very worthy of membership in our bar. And so I would like to move that the bar accept her membership and administer her the oath.
Hearing no dissent, the court is happy to grant your motion. Welcome.
Please raise your right hand. You swear or affirm that you comport yourself as an attorney and counsel of this court, uprightly and according to law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States of America.
I do.
Congratulations and welcome to the bar of the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit.
We welcome you to the bar and look forward to seeing you at the podium soon.
Can I take over again?
You can.
Then let's hear from Mr. Kirsch. You may proceed.
Good morning. This case involves our assertion of an arbitrator's misapplication of the law and of the Department of Justice's improper utilization and abuse of an indefinite suspension without pay in the circumstances where its employee is a target of an ongoing criminal investigation.
So what is your view about what it is necessary for the government to do in these circumstances?
Well, I think the court in Bonk and Perez talked about a possible conflict. Certainly, we would maintain that reasonable cause has been the standard from the to impose an indefinite suspension in these types of cases from its inception.
Reasonable cause for what? To prove that the crime has been committed, or to prove that there is a reasonable basis that will promote the efficiency of the service to conduct the indefinite suspension?
Well, reasonable cause, as it has been applied, as a reasonable belief from some, either an objective source by independent magistrates, by indictments, information, or an agency comprehensive investigation of the underlying matters, they may be able to get reasonable cause from that. But here, all they had was an OIG letter indicating that they had an ongoing investigation of possible criminal misconduct. Clearly, there is
substantial nature, right? Of a substantial.
The allegations are substantial. There could be a nexus if those conduct could be proven, but
what is the government to do while while this investigation is underway with respect to this employee?
Well, they could do what they've always done. And that they have several options. The first, they could put the employee on home duty without pay. Home duty with pay. The second thing they could do is reassign an employee to non-sensitive type of duties. There was
testimony. That was considered, wasn't it, in this case?
The warden indicated that it was considered, but there was testimony by a second line supervisor that there were other positions I don't have the exact appendix site, but there were other positions outside the facility in which the employee could have been assigned.
Well, that's kind of a fact-finding role that we're not in here, are we, at the appellate level, to second-guess the supervisors to the existence of those alternate positions?
Well, the other things they could have done is what they always have done, and that is dispense with a 30-day notice provision if they have reasonable cause that a crime has been committed. An agency can utilize that provision if they believe that if there is an indictment or other action.
But you're suggesting, it seems to me, the reason the burden is higher on the agency if they dispense with the 30-day notice is because there's a recognition that's not good for employees. And the 30-day notice requirement is something that helps employees. So it seems a little odd to me that you're here arguing that advocating dispensing with the 30-day notice requirement.
Well, they have that opportunity. The statute provides that to them. It doesn't seem that Congress
put a complaint. But the statute doesn't compel. I mean, you're not arguing here that they are compelled to not give him notice so that they will have to meet the particular standards.
No, certainly not.
So given that they were, you would agree then that they were within their rights to give him a 30-day notice, which is typically seen as helpful for employees, then why is the standard anything more than promoting the efficiency of the service?
This court suggested that, well, first of all, there was no meaningful opportunity to reply to the specific charges. All that was provided, again, was an OIG letter indicating that over a 2-year period of time, there may have been...
Well, they weren't charging him with having committed crimes. They didn't have a basis for charging him for committing crimes, right? That's not what this case is about. If that were true, they presumably would have discharged him, not just indefinitely suspended.
If we were to go on the justice's assertion that simply maintaining the order or the potential risk was enough in a case, then any criminal investigation, which they believe could be serious and could have those consequences, could result in an employee being placed on indefinite suspension without pay, in this case, for over 10 months.
What's wrong with that in a matter of this consequence, where the very fundamental nature of your position has been compromised?
I think it offends due process, for one. There was no meaningful opportunity to apply.
You get a chance to read the 30-day notice. It gives you that. You've got 30 days, and if you come forward and say, it wasn't me by any... In fact, I was in Salem at the time. It couldn't have been me. Then, of course, then they can take that into consideration. That didn't happen here, as we all know.
Well, in Cheney versus Justice, this court said that you merely can't, and that was a security clearance case where recognized less due process.
But in Cheney, the charges were very vague and ambiguous, and here there were specific statements of the type of conduct in question, the general dates involved, and it's quite different. And the place in which this activity occurred. So it's quite different from Cheney.
But we would maintain that the charges in Cheney indeed were more specific.
But
in Cheney, they talked.
But Mr. Good had the opportunity, didn't he, when he received that, to come forward, if he could have, and said, no way that could be me. There could be a complete rebuttal right there on the spot, if he was capable of doing that.
If I could respond to both of your points.
Yeah.
I think in Cheney, they talked about the charges were an abuse of the subpoena process. It was that he violated a confidentiality agreement, that he queried law enforcement databases. The charge here was that over a possible 2-year period, covering FCC of Petersburg and possibly other locations, that he engaged in bribery and allowing improper contraband into the facility. As we saw in Perez, similar type of charges that even involved a sting operation by Perez, against Perez, resulted in no indictment being issued. And the problem really is exacerbated by this court's decision in Richardson and then Salinas, providing that at the end of the day, even if an employee is exonerated, there's no assurance whatsoever that that employee will receive back pay. Indeed, in Salinas, this court acknowledged that it may just be that the employee never receives any pay or has any forum to challenge that.
You were going to tell us if the 30-day notice gave him every opportunity to respond if he could have.
The problem was...
Therefore, why is there any denial of due process?
The problem was that he was not given... He denied the charges. first of all, in a written reply. Denied generally, saying, and asked for, please provide certain specifics. The warden who made the decision in this case was not even aware, was not the same warden that even sent the matter off initially to internal affairs. So she knew nothing about the charges, made no independent investigation about it. Certainly, there could be a certain level of cooperation between an OIG and...
But that all suggests that in the context of an indefinite suspension, you get the opportunity to adjudicate, or we're supposed to be adjudicating, the underlying merits of the criminal conduct he's charged with. I mean, it's not a forum in which to duplicate what DOJ, what the indictment, or what the U.S. attorney is doing, is it?
I think the due process demands that an employee have, since it's not been contested that a property and liberty interests have been impacted by this, that you look at generally due process and the flexibility provided for it, to look at the interests of the employee, and you look at what might have been deprived by not providing the procedures that are accorded the employee. Here, the procedures are specific reasons that are to be provided to you in a meaningful reply. It also provides for a preponderance of the evidence. The cases have made it very clear that a preponderance in Dunnington and other cases where credibility, and Dunnington, excuse me, was an indefinite suspension case, that the credibility of key parties is in question, the agency must assure itself it has a sound basis for acting. The agency must determine whether it has enough material to go on. And in that case, there were information culled from criminal complaints and supporting allegations.
Was that a 30-day case or not?
That was a less than a 30-day case.
In other words, they had to satisfy the reasonable cause of the crime has been committed because there was an absence of a 30-day notice, which isn't the standard that's applicable here, given that there was a 30-day notice, correct?
Briefly discuss about the statute and the legislative history.
You're not going to contest the Perez case, are you?
I'm not going to contest the Perez case in that in its limited holding, saying that if you look strictly at the 7513B1 and the shortened 30-day notice period, you cannot gather simply from that statute a reasonable cause. But as Judge Dyke pointed out, the Administrative Procedure Act, Merit System Protection Principles, promotion of the efficiency of the service, and other portions of the statutes assure some reasonable basis.
That's a dissent.
I understand it's a dissent, but I...
So it has absolutely no weight other than how it persuades... which it didn't persuade the court earlier, did it?
Well, I think the court said that it had a very narrow issue before it, and those cases, and it was not argued, because they said that it appeared to them that its ruling in four other cases, three of which said that there was an independent reasonable cause standard, that was merely dicta, and relying on those cases was not enough. But I think the court certainly invited other considerations that may lead the court to establish some sort of reasonable cause standard. Even the government acknowledged there has to be some reasonable basis, that it cannot be arbitrary.
Do you want to save your rebuttal time?
Oh, sure. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Stern?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. When Warden Stansberry received a letter from the Office of Inspector General in July of 2007, she knew right away a few things. That one of her employees who worked in the prison as a case inmate manager...
Well, help us out here on the standard. I mean, you gave him 30 days notice. What could you have shown about the allegations? What possible responses could he have given to rebut the presumption of suspension? Okay.
Well, he basically would want to try to rebut the agency's conclusion that indefinitely suspending him in some way promoted the efficiency of the service. So he could have, as Judge Rader suggested, simply come forward and said, I didn't do it, you've got the wrong guy, the investigation is of another Edward Good, someone with the same name as me, I don't have a job that is closely related to these serious allegations, or the allegations are in fact not really so serious, or my indefinite suspension is not really going to promote the efficiency of the service. These are the lines of response that he could have come forward with. But the basic standard applicable to this adverse action, as with
any
adverse
action. So what is the next? I guess I'm bothered by the first criteria you laid out, because I thought part of the point of this is that the agency isn't in a position and ought not to be in a position to adjudicate the underlying criminal violation. So if he comes in and he says, I didn't do it, and I've got five witnesses that I'd like you to talk about that can all tell you that I didn't do it, does the agency have to go forward and do a further investigation of that information in this context?
No, because you're correct. It's not the underlying charges that are at issue here. It's the existence of the investigation. So, in fact, even if he does come forward with that kind of information, it may or may not affect the agency's judgment as to whether or not to go forward with the indefinite suspension. Because what we're looking at is the totality of the circumstances of the facts before the agency.
In what context? To establish what? That it promotes the efficiency of the service.
Exactly. That it promotes the efficiency of the service because, for example, in this case, the warden concluded that retaining Mr. Good on duty would represent a potential threat to the orderly operation of the prison, and therefore removing him promotes the efficiency of the service. Anything that he can come forward to that goes to rebut that in the warden's mind will help rebut the efficiency of the service standard, but I can't say that one single denial on the merits will be sufficient to overcome all of the circumstances that goes into determining whether or not indefinitely suspending an employee in a given situation promotes the efficiency of the service.
Well, what if the warden, based on what he hears, just happens to believe Mr. Good and says, you know, in my heart, I believe he's telling the truth and that he didn't commit the violation? Would it then be appropriate for him to continue the indefinite suspension notwithstanding that belief?
Well, if the warden genuinely felt that, then I think that the conclusion, the related conclusion would be, in most instances, and probably in this one, that retaining Mr. Good would not be a threat to the institution. But there, I can even imagine circumstances, and I realize we're kind of dealing in the hypothetical here, but there might even still be circumstances where even if the warden believed Mr. Good, it might still promote the efficiency of the service to indefinitely suspend Mr. Good. If, for example, the allegations were extremely serious and there was a lot of notoriety about it such that the public was fearful and Mr. Good's colleagues were fearful and they weren't able to efficiently work. I mean, that's why I come back to this totality of the circumstances evaluation to determine in each instance whether retaining the employee on duty during an ongoing investigation promotes the efficiency of the service.
In Perez, there was a lot of discussion of we've got a lot of cases floating up there. There was discussion in the dissent as well as in Judge Bryson's concurrence. Don't you feel like the standard you're proposing here in terms of the preponderance of evidence that it will promote the efficiency of the service bumps up against some of our precedent?
Well, as the majority pointed out in Perez, those cases that did apply a reasonable cause standard arose always in the context of instances where less than 30 days notice was given. And so there was a tendency for many, many, many years to conflate the crime provision of the short notice with the standards for imposing the indefinite suspension in the first place. But the statute, 7513, speaks only to the efficiency of the service. That's the only standard that Congress selected for all adverse
actions.
I'm not
talking about whether our precedent is right or wrong. I'm talking about is whether there's conflicting precedent.
Well, again, because those cases that use the reasonable cause standard did involve less than 30 days notice, arguably, as the majority, I believe, correctly found, any indication that reasonable cause was also necessary for the indefinite suspension was basically dicta, wasn't critical to the court's holding.
Maybe we need reasonable cause. Otherwise, a supervisor could always indefinitely suspend someone under the guise that it's just an efficient move, right?
Well, to say maybe...
Maybe they just want to save money. Maybe this is just a disruptive employee. And so they say, well, let's just indefinitely suspend them.
Well, that is, in fact, the standard that Congress elected. I mean, Congress could have chosen to put the reasonable cause standard into 7513A. Obviously, when Congress wanted to impose a reasonable cause standard, it knew how to do so. It did that in 7513B.
But efficiency of the service is a pretty broad, amorphous term. And if you can indefinitely suspend someone just because you think it's efficient, and we really created a system that gives confidence to employees?
Your Honor, it is a broad term. But remember that before there was the efficiency of the service standard, and I'm going way back to, I think, maybe the Pendleton Act, there was no standard. Employees, government employees, were absolutely at will. They could be dismissed for any reason and for no reason whatsoever. The government did not have to give any reason, and they could just dismiss an employee. The efficiency of the service was brought in to say, we don't want completely arbitrary action. We want there to have to be at least some reason for taking action against the employee.
But I'm suggesting
that
the breadth of that standard almost invites arbitrariness.
Well, it doesn't, because the investigation, as we suggest in our brief, it has to be at least a bona fide investigation. For example, if it was one that the employee could demonstrate was just pretextual and just really an opportunity for the agency to discriminate against him, had no relationship to the efficiency of the service, it would not be upheld. But the efficiency of the service is the standard that Congress elected to guard against arbitrary action. And the agency does have to come forward with some reason, ground, charge, call it what you will, and they have to relate that reason to some aspect, something that will promote the efficiency of the service.
And they've got the burden.
And they've got the burden. So in this case, they had an investigation by a fairly independent...
So what are the kinds of things that we... I mean, if here it was not an investigation by OIG and the U.S. attorney, but it was, you know, there's neighborhood gossip about it, that would be the kind of thing that might not be sufficient to satisfy the efficiency of the service, right?
I'm sorry, did your question...
There's no bona fide investigation.
That's correct, because the regulations that implement the statute talk about an indefinite suspension pending investigation.
What about if you were charged, there were an investigation going on, but it has little relationship to his ongoing duties?
Again, it would be difficult in that situation for me to imagine that the agency could meet, well, they might, but it would be much more difficult for the agency to meet the efficiency of the service standard, which is why this case, which involves allegations that are very serious, closely related to the job that that Mr. Good did, and arose in a setting, federal penitentiary setting, which very sensitive setting, it's clear the agency does meet the efficiency of the service standard in this case.
What safeguards are in place to protect employees like Mr. Good from trumped up charges? You could envision a scenario where inmates, for one reason or another, decided to sort of raise allegations just to get rid of a guard in the prison. What can the employees do to protect themselves against these kinds of trumped up charges?
Well, again, the efficiency of the standard, that is really the safeguard for the employee and the right to have...
It requires at least a reasonable basis for some sort of charge.
It does, and in fact, the efficiency of the standard, the service standard has in fact been described by some courts as a reasonable basis. The agency has to have a reasonable basis for taking the action. And that is the safeguard for the employee. The Congress, by selecting the efficiency of the service standard, looked at adverse actions basically from the perspective of the agency, saying they have to have some reason that protects the employee, but the reason has to be one that promotes the efficiency of the service, a standard that the agency is concerned with.
What seems particularly harsh in the context, I think, is perhaps the fact that at the end of the day, even if the employee is completely exonerated, and it is concluded by everyone that the charges were absolutely positively bogus, the employee, under our case law at least, doesn't get that bad.
Your Honor, that does seem harsh. And obviously, if I was in that position, I would think it was extremely harsh. Congress could have avoided that kind of outcome by selecting a different standard. For example, many discharge standards require a demonstration of misconduct or malfeasance or nonfeasance on the part of an employee. And Congress could have said, action under 7513 can only be taken where there's a demonstration of some misconduct or fault or malfeasance by the employee. But Congress didn't select that standard. They simply selected a standard that only requires the agency to demonstrate that its action promotes the efficiency of the service. And it's judged from the time the action is taken. So if at the time the indefinite suspension is imposed, it does promote the efficiency of the service, it is a justifiable, sustainable adverse action. And notwithstanding that somewhere down the road the employee may be exonerated, it doesn't change the nature of the adverse action when it was instituted. And though it does have some harsh aspects to it, I have to admit, it is the standard that Congress elected. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt because it looked like you had a question. If not, I was going to move on to just briefly discuss the notice that Mr. Good was provided in the context of his arguments about the Cheney case. In Cheney, this court did talk about the requirements of notice. Of course, Cheney also followed on the heels of Alston. In this case, as we pointed out in our brief, Mr. Good got very specific notice about what exactly was being investigated in this case. We're talking about bringing drugs and alcohol into the very prison where he worked during the years 2006 and 2007. That's at least as specific as the information that was given to Mr. Alston when he was told that his security clearance was possibly being suspended because of health reasons, and he wasn't even told the exact nature of the health condition, and yet the court found that notice to Mr. Alston was sufficiently specific. In this case, Mr. Good was told, you are being investigated for bringing in drugs and alcohol into the prison where you work. That certainly is enough to let him know what he's being investigated for and to either deny it or not respond to it, but in either case.
It may be more specific than in Cheney, but it didn't tell him who, exactly why, exactly when. It was a general period, over a couple of year period. How is he supposed to sort of prove a negative under those general circumstances?
Well, again, Your Honor, we're not talking about him proving the truth or falsity of the actual underlying conduct. We're talking about, and I'm taking this from the court's decisions in Cheney, Alston, other notice decisions.
The question is whether he had an opportunity to respond.
To respond, and to respond in a meaningfully focused way. So if the agency simply says, you know, you violated some of our regulations, that's pretty broad, doesn't really give him a chance to focus his response. But if they say, you brought drugs and alcohol into the prison, he knows where to focus his efforts and what specifically he's going to talk about.
How is he supposed to respond to that when he says, oh, I don't know when or who or what? You say drugs and narcotics, and I was engaged in some bribery over a two-year period of time, albeit at the prison. I don't know where to start in responding to that, other than to say, no, I didn't do it.
But again, Your Honor, the point of the response is not necessarily to combat the actual truth of the underlying allegation. Similarly, in the security clearance context, if the employee comes forward in Cheney and says, well, I didn't do any of those things, it's not going to affect the actual suspension of the security clearance because that's a determination being made not even by the agency, usually by another office. So it's really just to the extent that he can come forward and in some way combat the agency's conclusion that indefinitely suspending him promotes the efficiency of the service. So he might say, again, that drugs and alcohol, not really that serious or not really closely related to my job because I have no contact with inmates. Something that would go to the agency's charge case of demonstrating that the indefinite suspension promotes the efficiency of the service.
But as Judge Prost pointed out, if the merits of the underlying investigation are really not at issue, then what's the whole point of the degree to which the notice provides him with an opportunity to respond? It seems like somewhat of a hollow exercise.
Your Honor, the answer to that question, I think, just lies in the Cheney and Alston decisions because they are, I think, very analogous. The employee is entitled to an opportunity to respond and some notice of what's going on behind.
Under circumstances where the response will essentially have no effect.
Well, it's difficult to say in every case whether it could have any effect on the agency's conclusion that the indefinite suspension in that case promotes the efficiency of the service, but it might not in every case.
Assuming that the agency had a reasonable basis to go forward, and I think that's a fair assumption, then it almost seems like no matter what the employee says, is it going to have an effect?
Well, you know, it's without specific facts, it's hard to respond. I certainly wouldn't think that it would be the case that the employee could never say anything that would have some effect on the indefinite suspension. But the bottom line is that...
Well, I thought you were telling me that it would have an effect. He could say, the charges are bogus. Look, this isn't a real investigation. I'm not really the target. He could say that even if this is all true, it doesn't have any real connection to what I'm doing on my job. So he could make those kinds of assertions.
Yes, and I said that it could have an effect, but then in the end it would always come down to the totality of the circumstances that were before the agency at the time they made the decision, and whether those total circumstances, including the response made by the employee, still left the agency with sufficient basis to conclude that indefinitely suspending the employee promotes the efficiency of the service.
Thank you, Ms. Turner.
Thank you, Your Honors.
First, you have a little over 2 minutes.
Thank you. The opportunity to reply here would be particularly meaningless because the warden did not even know the specific nature of the violations. She wasn't the warden who even sent the matter up to begin with. She knew nothing more than what was in the OIG letter and indicated that. There was some questions about whether it was alcohol or tobacco or other things. There was no suggestion even of alcohol. She didn't know any of those things, didn't care to know those things, so there was no meaningful opportunity to reply. As far as a reasonable cause standard, I invite you to look at the scant legislative history on this. It says that the term suspension follows a definition of that term previously adopted by the Civil Service Commission in its policy issuances. The former FPM provided that except when an agency suspends an employee indefinitely pending disposition of a criminal action, the agency should not base an adverse action on a criminal indictment or a conviction. Instead, the agency should base the action on the proven acts of wrongdoing. Those were the citations made in the Yankovitz case by the Court of Claims. And that was what Congress understood was the prevailing standards. So thus, and that was independent, that provision was independent of a short notice period in a separate provision in that same FPM. So that Congress recognized that there was a conflated type of standard, that in an indefinite suspension, as it existed at that time, that it should not base that you can go only based upon reasonable cause from an indictment or a conviction. Otherwise, you were to go on proven acts of misconduct. Moreover, Peden Court and Paul Cover, the very reasons, and Martin was the first time that the MSPB talked about a reasonable cause standard independent of the 30-day notice that could come from the general promote the efficiency of the service standard, because they recognize the dangers and due process implications of subjecting an employee to an administrative hearing while the criminal action is pending. But if I may just say, Congress understood in a security clearance context that you could suspend without pay and chose not to do that here under 7532. Thank you.
Mr. Kirsch?
Yes.